This episode is brought to you by Paris Gourmet, delivering specialty foods and ingredients right to your restaurant, bakery, and bar. Learn more at parisgourmet.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you four stories about lost and found culinary treasures.
We are searching for what will be lost, and we're trying to rejuvenate it.
What we try to do is collect these sourdoughs that contribute to the biodiversity of sourdough in order to store them, to document them, and be able to preserve them for the future.
It's bringing back the history and just being part of that time that just, it's, there's nothing like it. You know, there's nothing like it.
When fame comes late, I'm sure it's just as sweet as when it comes earlier.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, gang, just want to let you know we've recently announced some new events in Los Angeles in May and San Francisco in June. The June event is a live show at the San Francisco Cooking School. For details, dates, ticket information, and more, please visit the appearances page on my blog, Tokeland.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
I wanted to educate, you know, and I really wanted to spread the word that you don't need to accept this, you know, not in a militant activist way, but in a way that isn't this fantastic?
Right.
You know, these white asparagus that come from Holland and these black truffles and this really good butter.
Yeah.
Butter, really good butter that somebody made over here, you know, and these chives that, you know, were not dried chives. Remember, when you wanted spices in 1979, unless you grew them yourself or you knew of something, some place to buy them, you went to the spice rack to get all the basil, dried thyme, dried everything, dried rosemary, everything was dried. And so the idea was, yes, look at this. Look at the color on the plate, green. I mean, it's the number one thing that I continue to train my chefs on. Is that nothing goes out of that kitchen if it doesn't have green on it.
That is Michael McCarty of Michael Santa Monica and Michael's New York, our guest this week on Andrew Talks to Chef. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am speaking, I would say, sotto voce today, low voice, because I am in a hotel room in San Diego, California, where I am participating in the Chef's Roll anti-convention this week. It's been a lot of fun, but it is early in the morning, and I don't want to wake up my fellow hotel guests. So I'm enthusiastic, but speaking in a low voice. Anyway, my guest this week is Michael McCarty, who I'll properly introduce in just a moment, but he is the restaurateur behind Michael's Santa Monica, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this month, and Michael's New York, which is 30 years old. I think he's one of the true visionaries of the restaurant industry, and I'll explain why in just a moment. But before I do that, I want to remind you all that there are still just under 3 weeks left to apply for the San Pellegrino Young Chef Competition. As I described last week, this is a global competition, the regional semifinals of which take place this year, and the North American semifinals will be in New York City in November. All 10 North American semifinalists will be interviewed on a special episode of this show, and the North American winner will be the subject of their own episode and will go on to compete in the global finals in Italy next year. This competition is open not only to chefs, but to most people who have been working in a professional kitchen for at least a year and who were born after February 1, 1989. Another way to put that is people, for the most part, 30 and younger. If you're a more, shall we say, mature chef, I'd humbly suggest that you might recommend this competition to some of your younger colleagues. I discussed this in greater detail on last week's episode, but in brief, the cornerstone of the competition is you developing a signature dish that shows your personal vision, unique skills, and creativity. For rules, details, and an application, visit sampellegrino.com and navigate to the competitions page, or find a direct link to the online application via the link in this show's bio on Instagram. And my Instagram handle for this show is @chefpodcast. If you go to @chefpodcast, click the link in the bio. The very topmost thing you will find at the page you are directed to is a direct link to the online application for this competition. Sam Pellegrino and Andrew Talks to Chefs recently entered into a promotional partnership, and I look forward to sharing and being a part of more programs with my favorite water in the coming months. Okay, Michael McCarty, I don't know how many of you listening to this show know of the legacy of Michael's restaurant, but first of all, the restaurant amazingly is going strong after 40 years. Secondly, it is celebrating its 40th anniversary this month, and it's a super important restaurant. It doesn't, I don't think, receive the credits for the innovations it made. First and foremost, you know, in the kitchen, it was one of the restaurants that really moved the ball forward on new American cuisine. But also as a restaurant, it introduced, and I should say Michael, our guest today, introduced a lot of things that have become very much the norm in restaurants. He was one of the first people to have what most of you listening to this show probably engage in on a daily basis, which is the nightly staff meeting pre-service. I know very few people, actually I don't personally know of anybody, these meetings may have been happening elsewhere, but in Los Angeles I've never interviewed or spoken to anybody who had attended a nightly service meeting in a restaurant prior to working at Michael's. So that was something. He also computerized a lot of the systems at that restaurant at a time when nobody was doing that, when computers were much larger mechanical beasts and a lot of people weren't very savvy in them. Certainly nobody had them in their homes. And there's a lot of other things he did. There are also a lot of hugely important chefs who have come out of that kitchen. And we talk about a lot of this in the interview. I do want to mention that we interviewed in New York City at his Michael's New York restaurant. He occasionally in the interview refers to 30 years. That is not a mistake. He's referring to the fact that the place where we were sitting is 30 years old. But the Santa Monica restaurant, the original Michael's, is indeed 40 years old. And I do want to tell all of you that on Sunday, April 28th, from noon to 4 p.m., at Michael's Santa Monica, there is a special tasting event going on to celebrate the anniversary. Some of the alumni of the restaurant who are returning for that event and whose food you can enjoy at that event include Jonathan Waxman, Mark Beal, Roy Yamaguchi, Kazuto Matsusaka, Miles Thompson, who was recently there and helped reinvigorate the restaurant, Sang Yoon, Brooke Williamson, and the current co-chefs of the restaurant, Jeff Luster and Matthew Wilson. And the $150 cover charge covers your taxes, fees, gratuity, and a signed copy of Michael's cookbook. And there's also going to be wines from his current beverage director. So I wish I were in Los Angeles for that event. I would definitely be attending. I hope some of you can make it. Go to Michael's Santa Monica's website for more information and to purchase your ticket. Okay, with that, I'm now going to invite you to join me as I sit at a table by the window of Michael's New York City a couple of weeks ago when we had this conversation about the long road it's been from the early days of Michael's Santa Monica in April 1979. Here you go. We're in New York. There's a big anniversary coming up out west.
Yes.
But before we talk about that, you know, it occurred to me walking over here, like so many people who are associated with the California movement,
right,
whatever you want to call it. I don't love the term California cuisine. Maybe we'll talk about that today.
Right,
but you're an East Coast. You were from the East Coast, like
yes,
many people.
Yep.
Who are associated with what happened in California in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
A lot of you guys were transplants.
Right. Well, of course.
But how do you square that? Is that something you've spent? You're a philosopher. Is that something you've spent time thinking about in your life?
Well, again, it's like happenstance. You know, I went away to France. I grew up in New York, and as I went away to France to learn to cook in Paris, and learn about wines and the whole restaurant show. You know, I was at the Cordon Bleu for 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. I was at the École Hôtelière for 3, mm-hmm. and at the Académie du Vin with the great Steven Spurrier.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came home, my parents had moved to Malibu, California.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of like we weren't from New York anymore. I had gone to, my parents lived in the Midwest for a while, and I had gone to a prep school in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, all right, let's go check out California. And it was fantastic. So in 75, I moved out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like unbelievable. It's like
what
perfect.
Struck you right off?
Well, first of all, it was like the Wild West in a mm-hmm. funny way. You know, there were basically no rules. A lot of people come there to reinvent themselves historically. Yeah. You know, you had the whole Hollywood thing. You had the beauty of the place. You know,
it's like Casablanca writ large.
It is.
Right? A
absolutely.
Little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very, very alluring. Beautiful. Temperature's unbelievable. The weather's fantastic. No bugs. You know? it's just amazing.
Yeah.
And so what happens is that it was like you are basically set to do whatever you want to do out there.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was out there. It's a very young city. People don't realize it, but the LA County Art Museum and the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion opened in 1965.
Right.
That was sort of the beginning of structured culture
mm-hmm.
out there. You, when you think about it,
I mean,
not 1865,
right,
you know, but 1965,
right.
And so it was just very, very, very welcoming, very
yeah.
open, and you felt this sort of sense of you could do whatever you wanted.
Mm-hmm. Now you strike me. It's always been. I don't even know if you and I have talked about this, but I've had this conversation about you with people like Ruth Reichel.
Yes.
The fact that you ended up in Los Angeles,
right.
more or less,
right.
a lot of people misunderstand this about L.A. L.A. is actually, yeah. what people refer to as L.A.
Yeah.
is actually a collection of municipalities.
Oh, huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
Of cities with their own mayors.
Oh, yeah, and, of course. Yeah. Well, my restaurant's in Santa Monica.
In Santa Monica. That is not technically Los Angeles.
No.
But
no.
you come out to, broadly speaking, L.A.
Yeah.
You come out, it's sort of the time of these, like, you know, producers getting famous and people like John Peters and
right.
these people getting written about. And
yep.
you have always struck me, as much as a restaurateur, you seem to me to be a producer. You're a big thinker.
Yeah.
You are scrappy.
Yeah.
You're resourceful.
Yeah.
And you are going to make if you want something to happen, you will make it happen.
Yeah.
Well, do you relate to those guys?
I do. In fact, that's how I always described Michael's in the very beginning it was theater. It was every night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the producer. That's what my role was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had all my chefs in the kitchen.
Right.
That I worked exclusively with and mm-hmm. intensely with mm-hmm. to create this menu.
Mm-hmm.
I had my front of the house staff because we had to reinvent service. We didn't want old-fashioned service, just
yeah.
like we didn't want old-fashioned production out of the kitchen. We didn't mm-hmm. want old-fashioned decor. So we took this opportunity to make the restaurant not only just, okay, it's showtime every night.
Yeah.
We wanted to make it beautiful and not a restaurant. So it didn't look like a traditional restaurant. It
mm-hmm.
looked more like a house.
Right.
So you were coming to somebody's home, hence the art collection.
Right.
I made it very clear to my to friends that I knew in the business, you know, where that I absolutely didn't want him wearing tuxedos because
yes.
every single restaurant in the United States of that caliber, of that sort of style, all wore tuxedos.
Yeah.
And I just said, that's not going to happen here. This is California. We were going to be outdoors. There was going to be light. I mean, I never forget, you know, you go to Chasen's in those days.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the window in the place.
Yeah.
You go to 21 Club, same thing. 90% of the restaurants were all enclosed.
And the bar was in usually the back.
In the back,
it
yeah.
wasn't this kind of accepted place to show up an hour
no.
early for
in
a
in this
cocktail.
Restaurant here in New York, the bar was in the back.
You moved it.
They moved it.
They moved
it. In the 50s, uh-huh. they moved it. When they built the garden room,
yeah.
they put the bar over here. But yep. originally, that physical bar was sitting right over there.
Yeah, like when people see Mad Men, right?
Right.
To make it easily understandable to younger
yep.
people today. And you see like Don Draper and Roger Sterling having a drink in a
right.
bar. It's like in the back of a restaurant.
Yeah,
it wasn't. It wasn't the welcoming area. It
well,
was sort of the dark area in the back.
And remember something. 99% of the people in the restaurant business in the United States, the high-end restaurant business I'm
yeah.
talking about, were European. They were
mm-hmm.
Swiss trained. They were German trained. They were
right.
Austrian trained. They were French trained. They
right.
were English trained. Very few Americans were actually in the business. Some
yeah.
of the restaurants were owned by Americans,
mm-hmm.
right? Like a Dave Chasen owned Chasen's, but every single person in the front and the back of the house was European.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it came from that sort of philosophy of very strict, the Escoffier food, the continental food, mm-hmm. you know, Perinos. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody can envision these rooms filled with these people. And I wanted to blow that wide open.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I wanted to, and I put them in, for example, like I asked my friend Jerry Magnan, who not only owned a clothes store mm-hmm. on Rodeo, but was in the restaurant business.
Oh, I didn't know
yes,
that.
Yes, he owned a handful of restaurants, mm-hmm. was very into food, very into wine.
Mm-hmm.
I said to him, I said, Jerry, I can't put him in tuxedos. I'm doing everything American, so I want a young American designer that mm-hmm. I can get in here that it sort of fits the look. Remember, you're sitting there in a room looking outside in the sunlight. Mm-hmm. And in California, it's all the time, mm-hmm. except for the last 3 months. But I mean,
right.
you know, generally.
Yeah.
And he came up, he says, I got just a guy for you. His name is Ralph Lauren.
Yeah.
And he had a little shop on Rodeo, and in the back corner was a little stand, basically. And so Ralph provided the uniforms, which he still does today here.
Is that right?
30 years later.
Wow. So can we just say, this was, just to put it in context, yeah. right? So Ralph Lauren, obviously now is iconic.
Right.
At the time was ascending.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of people don't know this. The Robert Redford version yeah. of Great Gatsby.
Right.
The costume designer for that movie, which I think came out in maybe 74, maybe a little earlier.
Right.
So a few years before you opened your restaurant
right.
was Ralph Lauren.
Yep.
Those were Ralph Lauren. So outfits. You hired the guy who outfitted the Great Gatsby.
Well, there you have it.
To do your thing. I've also often felt, you know, the tuxedos to what you did.
Right.
It's like past to present. It's yep. like it's like in The Wizard of Oz when the yep. beginning's in black and white and right. Oz is in color.
And it's exactly
you literally
what it
went
is.
From black and white to color
pink
in terms
shirts.
Of how people were costumed.
Pink shirts and British Racing Greed rep ties.
Yes.
Khaki pants.
Yes.
And, you know, the whole idea was to And people would comment. They would say, my God, those are so expensive, those shirts.
Right.
You know, my God, how did you afford to do that? You know, I said, Ralph. You know, he did.
Right.
It was great.
So can we just go through? There's a number of things that probably happen in any, let's call them serious restaurants. Not
right.
necessarily expensive.
Right.
But places that care about service today.
Right.
Places that are sort of on top of their games. And I'm not just blowing smoke. That right. started with Michael's Santa Monica.
Right.
First of all, I don't know anybody. Every restaurant now has a nightly staff meeting.
Right.
You talk about who's coming in, who's sitting where.
Right.
The chef might come out of the kitchen and
right.
say, this is the special tonight. Everyone gets a little bite, you know, takes a knife and fork and gets
right.
a little bite of it. Nobody has ever pointed out to me a place where they experienced that event before Michael Santa Monica.
Right.
And a number of people told me that was actually the first place they had ever seen it. People who had worked in other restaurants.
Yes.
People like George Barber, who's not
right.
a household name.
Right.
But had worked at the West Beach Cafe.
Sure.
Had worked
sure.
at L'Orangerie and around
yeah.
these other fancy places in L.A.
Yeah.
He'd never seen a nightly staff meeting.
No, no.
So what was the impetus for that?
Well, again, it was like I said before, it's theater.
Yeah.
So my role was to jazz everybody up, get them ready to rock and roll. And one of the things that I really worked on when we opened the restaurant was to break down this horrible barrier between the front and the back of the house. It was a terrible barrier. You know, they hated each other
mm-hmm.
For a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
And so I wanted the front of the house to interact with the kitchen staff.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted them not just have these nameless people cooking back there, but that they all knew each other. And the role of a chef, remember, in the old days was very... It was secondary, to the front of the house.
The maitre d'.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was just
the impresario.
Absolutely.
The host. The
yeah,
host of the
yeah,
party.
But, well, because yeah. the food was secondary and in a lot of cases.
Well, wasn't that also, sorry to interrupt you, but wasn't that also largely because in a lot of most restaurants that lean French,
yeah.
it was the menus were almost interchangeable.
Oh, yeah.
You were cooking out of, I call it the Escoffier playbook.
It is the Escoffier playbook.
So that's
what it was.
The food wasn't... There weren't signature dishes.
No. You were just trying to do the exact same dish that was being done in San Francisco, Chicago,
yeah.
London,
yeah.
Rome, whatever, because yeah. that's everybody's playbook. That
right.
was the playbook.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why the Nouvelle Cuisine Revolution in France, when I happened to live there during that
sure.
time, which was fantastic, showed that there could be massive change.
Right.
And, you know, I just took that that whole vibe and took it to California, which was completely open to anything mm-hmm. and everything. Mm-hmm. And the pre-shift meeting was extremely important because just like the which is why I, for example, people say to me, well, you know, you weren't really in the kitchen. And I said, you know, the reason why was because no one that was my customer base knew anything about anything we were doing. Mm-hmm. You couldn't go out there like you can today, where the people that are clients in these restaurants are brilliant. They're like Wikipedias on food,
right.
on ingredients, on right. this and on that. And you yes. know, they're just incredibly intelligent
yes.
and well-versed in this. I had to go out and explain what arugula was.
You were proselytizing.
Yes. I had to go out and I gave the specials. And I learned very soon on that the only way my staff was going to learn is for me to go to the table, have mm-hmm. them stand next to me. I will special the menu to them, which meant going through everything
mm-hmm.
and explaining, you know, why that raw diver scallop came from Maine and why it was a dry day boat scallop and not one that's been soaking in water
mm-hmm.
and why it was served with an heirloom beet puree with a French olive oil and fresh chervil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, none of that they even knew existed.
Yeah.
None of those things.
Yeah.
So it was a real learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so that translated to, it was class. You know, I built that when I was 25 years old, and I realized that unlike a lot of these restaurateurs that I knew that would say, oh, yeah, my guy's been here for 25 years, I couldn't even think of that.
Yeah.
So I had to think of the Michael's Restaurant as a school. That you got a freshman class every year.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will become sophomores. Some of them will stay on and become, you know, juniors and mm-hmm. seniors. And some will stay for post-grad.
Some will drop out.
And most of them will drop out,
right.
you know, because as – and it was pretty much exactly that. So I had to yeah. develop a system, not only in the front of the house of training,
yes.
but in the back of the house of training. So yes. it was really like – I say that like it's like those working hospitals, you know, the school hospitals mm-hmm. like UCLA yeah. where instead of you and the doctor and a nurse, you know, there's like 12 other people waiting, yes. watching you and yes. talking because
– I don't love that as a patient.
I know. Well, it was the same kind of yeah. a thing. I had to build a restaurant that could sustain itself by training. And I always say this in the kitchen. I said you're learning from the guy on the left and you're training the guy on the right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always that.
Can we just say, you just mentioned, you know, educating your customer, right?
Right?
This one of the things that's so remarkable about this time we're yeah. talking about, maybe like the first 5, 7, 8 years that Michael's
right.
was around, is there were people all over this country who didn't really know each other. You
right.
knew some of them because you traveled more than most people.
Right.
But there were people who were sort of doing similar things.
Yes.
Right? Like if you talk to anyone who ate at Jean Bonchet's restaurant
right.
just outside
yeah.
Chicago and what was it, in Wheeler,
Wheeling.
I think.
Wheeling.
Wheeling.
Yeah.
La Francais.
Yeah.
He would bring customers a taste of this thing they'd never heard of, foie
right.
gras.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Because it was the only way eventually he could hope to get them
exactly.
turned on to it.
Yeah.
Right? Very similar to what you were
by
doing.
By the way, I was selling my foie gras to Jean Bonchet.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So, the nightly staff meeting.
Yeah.
So part of it was to bridge the divide between the front and the back.
It was also like a pep rally, you know, the whole idea of exciting your people that this is our big night
mm-hmm.
and every night is theater and these are the people that are coming in and you must all know those people. You know, this is way before like they had computerized reservation systems mm-hmm. where you could keep track of your guests and who they did.
Sure.
They had these massive yeah. tomes.
Yes.
But it was something that had to be done. Because it was so new, every yeah. aspect about it, and because of our crowd, the diversification of our crowd was really intense. We had all of old Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
all of the old guard of mm-hmm. L.A., and we had all of young, new Hollywood.
The kids.
When I
the
say
upstarts.
The kids, you know, yeah. the Spielbergs and the Hanks and the
Geffen.
And the Geffens
yeah.
and the Barry Dillers, you know, they were all in their 30s,
yeah.
early 30s.
Yeah.
40 years ago.
Right.
And so, and they didn't have children. They went out every night. They went out 7 nights a week.
Yeah.
I mean, those 12 years were so insane because unlike old Hollywood
mm-hmm.
and in LA, mind you, you know, the entertainment industry wasn't really well received by the other old guard.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, you know, it was a lot of the entertainment titans ended up having their own chefs and they never went out. You know, they didn't go to country clubs,
right.
you know, because they weren't allowed in.
Right.
Because they were in the entertainment business, you know, we wouldn't socialize with those people in the mm-hmm. crazy entertainment business. And they all had their own chefs. It's funny because now here we are 40 years later, all those young people I talked about,
yeah.
they all have their own chefs now and they all
right,
maintain
right,
at home.
Right, right, right.
It's gone full circle.
Yeah. Did you, was there, you know, it's interesting, because I did a lot of theater when I was a kid. When you talk about the pep talk,
yeah.
When you were younger, before, I mean, you were only 25 when you opened this place, but when you were in high school, when you were in prep school, did you do any theater?
I did a little bit.
Were you ever in a band? Like, where does this reference point come from?
Because people who haven't done theater, there's
all kinds of different, I can still remember warm-up exercises that my drama teacher would do with us before a play.
Exactly.
And it got everyone synced up.
Absolutely. Well, that's what it was. I mean, I got the inspiration for all of that came from my parents, because my mother and father entertained a lot.
Yeah.
And my father was a very interesting individual who worked for General Electric, but he was in corporate public relations. So it was all about relationships. It was all about talking to people. And my mother was a fairly gregarious woman, and it was the same thing. And their friends were. So I grew up in this little milieu of that. And then when I was in high school, I did do theater. When I went away to France as a junior in high school, we were very involved. We had one teacher who was our English teacher who happened to create sort of an experimental studies program, a group dynamic thing, which was sort of coming of age at the time. After the 60s, a little bit more formalized, you know, less hippie, more very, very stringent the way you do your exercises, brain and physical, before you do theater. And we produced all these, you know, great plays in Europe and in French and in English.
Were you on stage or were you in the you producing director?
Well, I learned very soon that I really liked being on the producing side rather than on the stage. You know, I didn't like the repetitiveness of learning lines. I love jazz, so I love to improv.
You love improv. You like troubleshooting. Putting out fires. That stuff got your juices going.
Exactly. So I'm a big proponent of, and I've always used this analogy when I talk to and train people. I say, when you're looking at a dining room like this, you want to say to yourself, not to be a negativist or a pessimist, but what's wrong with this picture?
Right.
Your eyes have got to be trained where they're automatically looking for the flaw.
Yeah.
Because if you get it first, then your customer never sees it, never, you know, has to deal with it, etc. You know, whether it's, that's why if you look in this dining room right now, every single one of these tables is set exactly the same. The chair is in exactly the same position. That's the other thing that we created at Michael's in Santa Monica, which was table numbers and seat numbers. You know, they have that famous term where the waiter comes to the table and auctions off the food. Who got the chicken? Who got the this and that? I forbid that. You see, I wanted people to be able to just, that's why we created runners. You know, they used to have front waiters and back waiters and this and that. And I said, no, we're going to just get rid of all of that. We're going to have waiters that never leave the floor, that they take an order and they hand it to a runner or a busboy, anybody going back to the kitchen, and they take that in and they hand it to a cashier. Because I wanted to, in France, they had cashiers that just sort of centralized everything so that the waiters could be out on the floor full time.
Yeah. You still will see that in some old hotels. It's now called the Majestic, but the Awani, we used to be the Awani. Yosemite, there is a cashier almost in a throne in the middle of that kitchen.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that was the... That provided a lot of flexibility and a lot of fluidity amongst the service staff. And it also provided the fact that you had this central ordering system right in the kitchen, you know. And so there was constant conversation with the chef, et cetera. Expediting, you know, coming up with runners, you know, who ran the food back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and became really adept at it. You know, creating a team of a busboy and a waiter in a section, not all over the map. You know, so these six tables are yours. And that does not mean you don't cross over if someone in the next session needs something.
Like they're drowning, you don't ignore them.
Right. Service was a very big aspect of that. You know, I mean, in the very beginning, again, as part of including the kitchen and breaking down that barrier, I had a tip pool system, which I learned about in France. And 10% of the gratuities went to the kitchen staff. And that really did a lot of goodwill between the front and the back, because it was always, unfortunately, I had very young people working. So it wasn't like,
fortunately or unfortunately?
Fortunately. Yeah. You know, so I didn't have to train these old dogs, you know, basically these new tricks. So people were very receptive. I prefer to hire, not that there were people that were, you know, the people that I hired had barely worked in any other restaurants because they don't fit that dynamic.
Right.
So that worked out really well. And, you know, until we were told that it was illegal, of course.
Well, can we talk about this for 1 second? Because I think, you know, the whole tipping thing is it's so in the news lately, right?
Right.
Like Danny Myers eliminated it.
Right.
My friend Amanda Cohen at Dirt Candy does not have tipping.
Right.
It seems to be something that pops up every now and then.
Yeah.
But it really had a moment back in these days.
Well,
Alice Waters.
Yeah, well.
Barry Wine here in New York at the Quilted Giraffe,
who
to this day, no surprise, he's a former lawyer.
Yeah.
Makes an amazing case for it.
Yeah.
But what's your case for it?
Well,
for including the kitchen.
In 1979, towards the end of the year, we had a labor audit, and nothing was fine. Everything was fine.
Right.
Except for they asked on the check stubs, why is the kitchen staff getting gratuities? You know, it'd say right on there, gratuities, on a weekly basis. And I said, oh, we're very proud of that. This is fantastic. This is what we've done. I just explained everything. She said, well, I'm sorry, but that's illegal. So I said, what are you talking about?
Right.
Because, you know, we were one of the first restaurants that actually paid overtime. They did not pay shift pay.
Right.
Shift pay was a big deal.
Where you got paid for that day,
whatever
whether
it
you worked 10 hours or 18
hours. With your experience, you're at $25 an hour, a shift pay.
But
you're
shift 35. Could be like, it could be 16, 18 hours.
Oh, in fact, it was double shifts in a lot of cases.
Yeah, right.
Especially in the kitchen. Yeah. I mean, you know, it was all of the nightmares that everybody knows about were actually true.
Yeah.
And the labor board was just beginning to get into that.
Yes.
So, I said to them, I said, well, what can I do? So she got out the book. We looked at all the laws.
Mm-hmm.
And the tip thing was clearly, it's the same statute on there today as it was then. But they had a service charge that could be added that was considered and legally defined as income to the restaurant. And it was therefore subject to sales tax.
Okay.
So what I did was I said, okay, I'm going to go all French on this thing because I remember the service compris.
Right.
So we included the service compris. And I sat down and I did all kinds of accounting and I came up with the idea that here's what we could establish in terms of the front and the back of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on to do that in 5 cities and 5 restaurants for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
I did that from 1979 until 1995.
5 cities. And so you were including the Rattlesnake Clubs?
Denver.
Is the thing you did with Jimmy Schmidt.
Yep. Denver and Detroit were Rattlesnake Clubs, and Washington was Adirondacks. Mm-hmm. We had it, and in New York, when I opened here 30 years ago, we had it.
Okay.
Until 1995.
Got it.
And I finally just said, you know what? I hired two young people to come in 1995 for Santa Monica. The Great Recession had occurred there for two years. We'd had everything. We'd had the fires and the earthquakes and the mudslides. We had OJ. We had the Rodney King riots. We had the aerospace industry collapsing. We had the construction industry crashing. I hired Sang Yoon and David Rossoff, and they came to me, and I sat them down, and I said, okay, let's talk about everything. And I said, what do you see as absolutely has to be changed here for you guys to be able to do what you need to do with me? And they said, we got to get rid of the service charge. And I said, you're 100% correct, because I have spent the last 15 years in 5 cities explaining it not only to the public, you can't tell me what to tip,
right?
But trying to maintain and keep great wait staff in the front, because they could, in those days, remember something. Tips were almost always gratuities in cash.
Mm.
So nobody declared their tips. I mean, once credit cards and everything, you know, it morphed into reality,
yes.
You know, people started declaring their
tips.
Yeah. But so it was even a double problem because not only that, et cetera. So we stopped that. But the real problem today is just like smoking. When they started the no smoking laws, and Beverly Hills passed their own no smoking law. And everybody goes, okay, this is great, et cetera. Guess what? Everybody went a block over to West Hollywood to eat in the restaurant and smoke.
Yeah.
If it was a universal thing, then it would make sense. The biggest problem with it, and Danny Meyer will tell you and anybody else will tell you, is that it's enormously expensive to run it that way. Why? Because all of a sudden you're adding 20% to your volume. So instead of doing 5 million, you're now doing 6.
Mm-hmm.
That means you have income of that magnitude. That also, but more importantly, that means that all your insurances, your workman's comp just went up by 20%.
Yeah.
Because it's based on your payroll. your liability insurance and all of those things. It's based on your annual sales.
Well, you also have a PR problem, right? Because people are looking at your menu, and most people don't live and die by the news of the hospitality business.
Sure.
So if you don't connect that, Danny Meyer's restaurants are no tipping.
Right.
You see prices that seem high.
Yes, well, that's one thing.
And
that's
so you have to, that's like, much like you used to have to educate tables about the scallops.
You have to do that.
There's a sales job.
And that's
that
even harder.
At every table.
Because at least on my checks at the bottom, there'd be service charge 20%, service included. My prices were the same for the entrees and the appetizers and everything, you see. So he's even got a tougher battle with the public.
Yeah.
And we already know, and he's talked about it, he's had a very tough time maintaining staff because it is difficult
when it's
you're an island in the middle of the ocean and everybody else is going the other way.
Mm-hmm.
So
what was your, you know, there's a line, it feels to me like what your whole arc is so interesting to me because you obviously are a Francophile.
Right.
You obviously love,
completely.
You love France, you love French cuisine, you love the culture, the whole thing, right?
Right.
Scott Fitzgerald had a great line that said, "Great art is the contempt of a great man for small art."
Yes.
And much like many people of your generation of chefs and restaurateurs, I feel like as much as anything else, what you did in many ways was a response to the way things were done elsewhere. And when I say elsewhere, I mean in France.
Oh, absolutely. Complete response.
So
complete,
even though
response
you have
to
a lot, you have a lot of affection and respect for it, it seemed to me that you saw ways that it could be better, more humane, more user-friendly.
Absolutely.
More, right? Can you speak to this?
Yeah.
Can you speak to this dichotomy?
Sure. Well, because you remember something, and that's why I was extremely fortunate to have been there in the early 70s, because not only the cooking schools that I went to taught Escoffier food.
Mm-hmm.
That was the curriculum. Here's your book. Read it.
Yeah.
Because we're going to do everything in there.
Yeah.
The Guide à l'art culinaire, you know. Mm-hmm. That's what you're going to do. But I was there while Michel Gérard, for example, was creating Cuisine Masseur, why Trois Gros and Freddy Girardet and Paul Bocuse were beginning this transformation. So
You're talking about the people who would, as a group, be referred to as the Nouvelle Cuisine.
Exactly. They're the ones that started the revolution. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that said, we don't have to do it exactly like this. We can do it like this. Less is more, quality of the ingredients. You see, regional started to come into play there. Mm-hmm. We talked about California cuisine being a label. They called it California cuisine in those days because it was the region where we were using the ingredients from the area, the philosophy of the area, the vibe of the area. Now, of course, the United States, every state has their own regional food.
Sure. And
there. Go to France, same thing. Go to Italy. Remember Italy? Northern cuisine with the white sauce, Southern cuisine with the red. Now every single department has its own pride and joy of food.
Yes.
So the answer was that spark I saw I participated in. I learned very early on in Paris that it was going to do me no good to work in any of these kitchens. I worked at La Serre one night as a friend said, I have my friends there. So I went and worked one night, and I realized that it was so archaic in that kitchen.
How so?
Just so old-fashioned, and I didn't even know what old-fashioned was. I mean, it was just so, it was non-productive. People standing there doing the same thing. You know, they make the joke, you know, you're peeling potatoes for 9 months before you go on to the green beans.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And I said that's not, I don't want to say the word American, but it's not contemporary. It's not the way of efficiency. So that
it's also dysfunctional.
Oh, totally
it?
Dysfunctional. But remember something, the way that France worked and all of those states, countries, is they had free labor. Because the culinary schools would send them all this labor to stage.
Yeah.
And remember something, the discipline was needed in a lot of those kitchens to the bad extreme because these are all teenagers.
Right.
They're all goddamn teenagers. Right. They go to school after ninth grade.
Yeah.
You either go to the baccalaureate or you go into the trade schools.
Yes.
So, you know, you're dealing with a difficult situation. And at any rate, so it all just started to unfold. Paris is such a fantastic city, and the beginning of the 70s was magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
The 60s had just recently closed, you know, and it was just a wonderful time there. And this revolution was occurring, and, you know, Leal was still there. So I'm living in this fantastic, you know, Italy on steroids, you know what I'm saying? You know,
right.
And it was just unbelievable,
yeah.
You know, the sights, the smells, the whole thing, you know. And this little revolution was afoot. And it was, you know, Go and Mio came out. And
can you explain what people won't know?
Okay, so Go and Mio were two guys that decided that the Michelin Guide was, like we've just been talking about, was old school.
Yeah.
Tired, old school.
Stale.
Had a different set of criteria as to what rated with something great versus okay versus whatever. So they came out with this whole system, not on stars, but based on points. You know, like this, funny enough, like the school system, like when I went to school in France.
Yeah.
Everything's based on something out of 20. You know, you got a 14 out of 20. You got an 18 out of 20. Nobody ever got a 20 out of 20. You know what I mean? So, but they continued that same philosophy.
We should also mention they actually coined the term Nouvelle Cuisine.
Mm-hmm. And because that's what it was. It was new food.
Yeah.
It was new cooking. And that was the best way to do it. And so when I came back to the States, I realized that, you know, we had a completely beautiful blank canvas to do all this stuff on. And I had picked up, I mean, I'm so glad, though, that I learned the Escoffier, because that's like learning Latin. And, you know, you're becoming fluent in the basis for what has been known worldwide.
The roots of everything.
The roots of everything food. Right there. That's it. This guy codified it. Escoffier codified it in that book. And so once you learn that, you then riff on that. And so that's, you know, and but seeing, you know, eating at Freddy Girardet's, eating at Paul Bocuse, eating at Frere Trois Gros, you know, in 1974, you know, was just this magnificent experience. And you saw it. So you go to a Le Serre at the time, and then you go down and eat with one of these guys, and you go, oh, my God, and Michel Girard, you know, he had Pot-au-feu out there. And you know, they just started this feeling. And so when I came to the States, I said, okay, we can do this. You know, we're going to Americanize it. We had to start with the farms because there was basically nothing growing here. That's why we started the duck farm, because there were no good ducks. And that's why we flew in so many things. I always make the joke, I should have started FedEx, because I was having my guy. They had just moved the market when I left France to the airport, to Rungis. So I had my old guys that I used to buy from, and I would say, okay, put it in the styrofoam box.
When they also hide stuff, like, didn't you have them the hide cheese, something under?
All the cheese was hid
because
it was non-pasteurized and it was illegal to import. But then you put it in the false bottom and you put all the fish on top of it. So nobody was going to mess around with the fish. And we brought in the greens, we brought in seeds, we brought in all this stuff. And we started, Dennis Weiss, a guy who worked at Northern Produce, it was a family business, we started going out and saying, okay, let's start to get these people going here. And it worked. And it's funny because if you just look in timelines, when I opened here 10 years later in 89.
Here in New York.
I had to fly, yes, in New York. I had to fly all my greens that were being grown there now to here.
The reverse commute.
And then all of a sudden, within 5 to 10 years, you know, New Jersey, everybody here started doing all of this stuff and growing it. And it was fantastic. You know, New Jersey became the Garden State again. In real life.
So, you know, a lot of people I speak to about your contemporaries, right? The most probably direct was Larry Forgione,
Who
had an American place here in New York and was the chef at River Cafe before that. You know, he said to me explicitly, you know, none of us were trying to change the world. Like, in his case, he was an absolute hero of sourcing. Went to, you mentioned FedEx. They used to have stuff shipped. When he was at River Cafe, from all over the country, stuff that he had tracked down, shipped to JFK, and a couple of times a week, Buzzy O'Keefe, who owned that restaurant, would send a van
to pick it all up.
There was no FedEx. But Larry said, I'm not, I wasn't looking to change the world. I just wanted this stuff for me. Like, I'd seen what you needed in, when I was in Europe, and I just wanted that for me. But I got to tell you something, Michael, when I, ever I speak to you, I actually feel like you were trying to change the world. Like, I actually feel like your ambitions went beyond the walls and the open out, the open back of Michael Santa Monica. Is that accurate?
I think it is.
Did you want to have a domino effect?
Yes, I did. I wanted to, you know, Johnny Appleseed it. I wanted to, I wanted to educate, you know, and I really wanted to spread the word that you don't need to accept this, you know, not in a militant activist way, but in a way that isn't this fantastic? You know, these white asparagus that come from Holland and these black truffles and this really good butter. Butter, really good butter that somebody made over here, you know, and these chives that, you know, we're not dried chives. Remember, yes, when you wanted spices in 1979, unless you groom yourself or you knew of something, some place to buy them, you went to the spice rack to get all the dried basil, dried thyme, dried everything, dried rosemary, everything was dried. And so the idea was, yes, look at this. Look at the color on the plate, green. I mean, it's the number one thing that I continue to train my chefs on. I said, nothing goes out of that kitchen if it doesn't have green on it. Because I know if it's got green on it, it's got a fresh herb on it. It's got a fresh, some kind of many different kinds of salads. Now you go to a farmer's market in California, you come to the one in Santa Monica, it's probably 300 different kinds of herbs.
Such an amazing
300
place.
Different kinds of greens.
Yeah.
You know, the kales and the chards and all the lettuces. I mean, I remember that there was no arugula here, and we brought in five kinds of arugula. And you know, now you go to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, and you can have five different people growing five different kinds of arugula. None of that stuff that you see in the supermarket that, yeah, has been bred to death.
Right.
There's nothing in it anymore.
Yeah.
It sort of looks like it. But it's this and,
yes,
that.
Yeah.
So the idea was, yes. I mean, it was for me because that was a personal satisfaction. Mm-hmm. It was sort of my act. It was my game. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to do.
This episode is brought to you by Paris Gourmet, a leading specialty food importer and distributor servicing the New York tri-state area and beyond from coast to coast. I'm Jordan Werner Berry, the host of Modernist Breadcrumbs here on HRN. When it comes to freshly baked artisan bread, it's key to pair it with butter that's made with the same amount of care and attention. And you don't have to go all the way to France to find truly amazing butter. Bourmont 83% is an American butter made using traditional French methods. It's produced by a dairy cooperative in New England. And as a Vermont native, I love that this delicious butter is made locally by family farms. Bourmont 83% is great for cooking, baking, and serving on your table with fresh breads and artisan cheeses. It's proudly distributed by Paris Gourmet to restaurants and grocery stores around the tri-state area. Learn more about Paris Gourmet and all of their gourmet savory foods and pastry ingredients at parisgourmet.com.
Hey, are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Kathy Irway, and I'm the host of Eat Your Words here on HRN. Every week I sit down with food writers to talk about their newest work, from colorful cookbooks to food memoirs to exposés on the food industry. It's all meaty topic for discussion. You can find Eat Your Words wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. I'm going to return you to the rest of my interview with Michael McCarty in just a moment. Before we do, I haven't done this in a while. I think we've gained some new listeners recently. At least that's my impression from the various messages I'm getting on various platforms. So I do just want to mention, if you are not yet following the show on Instagram, please do that. The handle, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is @ChefPodcast. We'd love to have you follow us there. We do post every time a new episode drops, so that's one way to keep up. The best way, of course, to keep up with the show is to subscribe at Stitcher or iTunes. And if you do subscribe on iTunes, we would greatly appreciate a review. We've had a couple of new ones recently, and it really does mean a lot to us. I've explained this in the past. This is not just an ego thing. The more we get reviewed, the more we move up the food chain of how we show up in people's searches. So when people search for a podcast, say, and simply plug in the word chefs as opposed to the title of this show, the more reviews and ratings we have, the higher up that list of results we go. So we would really appreciate if you did that. And another reminder, Michael McCarty, as some of you may know, is one of the people featured on the cover of my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. The cover photo is the opening promotional photo from Michael's Santa Monica. So it's a restaurant that's very near and dear to me, and also gave me an excuse to remind you all that I do have a book out. It came out in paperback last month, and if you haven't read it yet, I'd love if you picked it up. I think it's got a lot of important history in there, and hopefully an enjoyable read. And with that, I'm now going to return you to the rest of my interview with Michael McCarty. I hope you enjoy it.
Can we talk about the American thing for a second?
Yeah.
I'm talking about the food. So
yeah.
It's a very subtle thing. You know, you, at the time that Michael's opened, quickly became known as one of the bastions of new American cuisine.
Right.
Okay. Then, you know, you go and pick up the first cookbook you did.
Right.
And honestly, and I hope this isn't an offensive comment, yeah, it looks like a French cookbook.
Well, of course.
Right? But
we've spoken, it's been a few years, but you point to you point to subtleties,
right?
Like you told a story once. Right. She actually doesn't even remember it, but I remember it vividly because you pantomimed it.
Yeah.
Nancy Silverton.
Right.
Came in as a cashier.
Right. Speaking of cashiers.
Thankfully found her way to pastry.
Right.
You would talk to her about the way she whipped cream.
Yes.
And that you wanted her to whip it very aggressively.
Yes.
You wanted it to be a little more, have a little more sort of body to it.
Exactly.
Than the way a French person would do it.
Right.
And that to you was American.
Exactly.
There was something about that.
Exactly.
Right? There were ingredients that found their way into compositions at your restaurant that maybe wouldn't be as common in France.
Right.
But the context was very French.
Right.
Very nouvelle cuisine.
Right.
These little subtleties.
Yeah.
I think what this all speaks to is the fact that when things change in any field, certainly in food, it really is baby steps.
Oh, it is.
Like to look back now.
Yeah.
And like at that cookbook.
Right.
Which is probably as close as you could come to seeing what a meal looked like at that restaurant.
In those days, yeah.
You go, new American? Really?
Yeah.
But I think it's easy from the vantage point of 2019 to not get it.
Right, exactly.
Can you just speak to the...
Well, yeah, because...
What it was, like these sorts of decisions and how
you said,
big they were at the moment?
You said baby steps, and that's true, because we were trying to accomplish so many different things, so many dimensions and layers of the restaurant business. We were trying to create a new American restaurant. And within that, we featured the entire experience. And, I mean, I'll tell you, that's if you read the book and read the text, you'll see that's what we've talked about. We're creating this experience that includes really good food that's beautiful and gorgeous and all that routine, using the best ingredients you can buy and not fucking it up, you know, not screwing it around. You know, like today you can go to places. And it happened in the late 80s there where people – they got so nutty that they put 80 ingredients in a dish instead of three, you know. And today they use the term pans. It's like instead of a three pan or a two pan, it's a six pan. Yeah, well, you can't do six pan. One of the things we had to do in the early days in 78 when I was touring the handful of French restaurants which existed in L.A. to get a sense of the market, I realized that the food needed to be simplified because whereas they were doing 50 to 75 people a night, I was anticipating doing 150 to 200 a night. And so therefore you must adapt and change and evolve the way you prepare your food. So for example, we took the bones out of everything because, you know, so my little lamb saddle was like you could perfectly cook it. A la minute was the also way we were going. None of this was pre-prepared. Everything was done a la minute. And so how do you prepare for 175 people, for example, the food, the menu that we're talking about, you know, angel hair pasta. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about the baked goat cheese salad, you know, the Dover sole, the saddle of lamb, the squab, the quail, everything so that you can maximize it using the flavors of these things. And, you know, I never brined anything. I marinated things in olive oil and herbs, et cetera. But everything was pretty clean. And so that's the way we were able to produce it. So that's how we looked at all of the food. Buying those best ingredients, cooking them as simply as possible, presenting them beautifully, and accenting them, you know, not just salt and pepper and lemon, you know, but acid. Acid was the number one theme that I explained to my staff, and I continue to explain it, that you can often say, you know, well, that dish tastes good, but there's not enough acid in it. There is no acid, you know, or it's be like saying that there's, it needs salt, it needs seasoning, so to speak. So these were these fundamental things that began to evolve. For example, my squab, for example, we had one guy who grew the best squab, and it was there already. It was phenomenal, and he inherited this company from his grandfather to his father to him, and he's still there. Gary Carpenter used to be in the middle of Pasadena.
Okay,
imagine that.
Okay,
and then they sort of swept him out of town, and now he's in the funny town named Carpinteria. Mm-hmm. So it's Gary Carpenter in Carpinteria. But he had the best product. It was better than in France. And that sort of gave me the inspiration, you know, to see that we could do this here. We could get these ingredients going. And it was just a matter of, like my ducks, they ate a fantastic feast every day. We never used pellets or any of that stuff or hormones. Or we didn't even know about that. But we fed them, you know, Milo and corn and everything, oats, anything that we had, we would develop this thing. I learned about it from the guy in Australia. But the whole idea was to simplify, buy the best ingredients, and not mess it up, you know. But to do, I used to say sauce is very important. People say, oh, we don't like sauce, you know, because really sauce was created to sort of cover up the protein. Mm-hmm. And I said, no. I use it as the bridge between the protein and the wine. You see, so that's why all of my sauces that we created were built from fantastic stocks as the basis, mm-hmm. okay, old-fashioned and Escoffier, but they were modernized in the sense that I didn't put tomato paste in them or I didn't put tomatoes in them because I found that to be too acidic. I'd rather have the stock itself shine, and I always used shallots, and I always used a wine, whether it was a sherry mm-hmm. or a vinegar mm-hmm. or it was a white wine or it was a red wine, etc. So, for example, the squab would be with a Pinot Noir cassis sauce. You see, so you have beautiful cassis that grow here, mm-hmm. and even the frozen ones are better than the fresh ones.
Right.
But nonetheless, I mean, even in the Santa Monica Farmers Market, as far back as 38 years ago, by the way, Laura Avery just resigned. She just retired.
She was the
fearless leader of it from the beginning.
Well, I hope it's in good hands, because that is a special place.
I think it is.
Yeah.
But at any rate... So the idea was, yes, we were, of course, infused in French, and we wanted to Americanize it. And so every day, every step, every time we found something seasonal, mm-hmm. we would say, okay, wow, look at these Sacramento Delta asparagus, mm-hmm. you know, in 1979. You go, whoa, you know, because guess what? After the war, throughout the 60s, stuff came. All those vegetables were frozen in the frozen mm-hmm. food case, mm-hmm. or they were in the cans. Mm-hmm. So the beginning of, as I said, the people that were on this game in California was beautiful because you could grow this stuff all the time.
Yeah,
like Ventura County, they don't have, Oxnard Plain is one of the five growing regions in the world. And they don't just get the one crop of wheat, you know, mm-hmm. every spring.
Right.
And do it over the summer, and then you're ready to go for next year. They can get up to 3 to 5 crops a year in some of those areas.
Yeah.
And they've learned sustainable farming, so they know how to rotate crops. They rotate the property so you don't kill the earth. Mm-hmm. But they're in an area where it can grow. So it all made sense. And then, of course, the burgeoning California wine market. You know, the world is very small. And with the American Institute of Wine and Food that I was very involved in founding mm-hmm. at the time in 1979-80, I learned all about Northern California. I had learned it from Vance Christensen, who was a teacher who was infatuated with California wine at Cornell when I took mm-hmm. a summer program when I came back. So when I went out there, I had already had a briefing, like a little game plan. Not that there were that many. Mm-hmm. You know, you had maybe a dozen to two dozen maximum.
Yeah.
And then you had the big guns. You know, you had the Engelnooks and the Almaden and mm-hmm. the Gallows and mm-hmm. things like that. But it was really Dick Graff I met, Robert Mondavi, Richard and Tecla Sanford, Joe Phelps, mm-hmm. I knew from Colorado. He was a builder. Mm-hmm. You know, Phelps is a huge building company, and he built all these wineries for his friends.
Right.
And then he said, screw it, I'm going to do my own.
Right.
And then Phil Reich, my guy, you know. Yes.
Explain who that was.
Well, Phil was like, I sort of referred to him as the first sommelier, even though he would never dare be called a sommelier, but that's what he was.
Yeah.
When I came back to France, I went to Colorado to see my brother and ended up cooking there for a year, teaching French cooking in French. And the head of the French Department of Experimental Studies set this class up. And I said, well, okay, so who knows anything about wine in this town? He said, whoa, you won't believe this. So they had a thing called the Shrine Liquor Mart, mm-hmm. and Phil Reich was a wine guy. And the owner of it was insanely in wine. To give you an example, he got the same allocation from the Napa Valley of the wines that were available as the entire Southern California got. That's how intense this town mm-hmm. was. So I found Phil before I opened, and I said, you got to run the wine program here. You know, you and I have worked together. This is really great. You know how to pair with my food. Mm-hmm. You know what to do. Because I'd go to him with my budget. I said, here's $25. Here are the 5 courses we're teaching today. This is what they are. This is what they have in each dish. This is what the sauce is. And he would then back into that. And he said, and in those days, wines were so inexpensive. It was fantastic.
He also, this all sounds so quaint today, Michael, mm-hmm. but you were very, I know you're proud of how you started to computerize things.
Right.
He had a computerized wine list.
Yeah.
That was a new thing.
That was brilliant. Well, we had a complete computerized system.
Yes.
So our cashier that Nancy did, you know, it was a point of sale directly tied into our mainframe.
Yes.
We had a mainframe the size of this table that had air conditioning on.
Yeah, it's hard for people to get this now, but that was a new thing.
5 gigabyte hard drive.
Yeah.
5 gigabyte, yeah. And then we had removables depending on what you were doing.
Yeah. I mean, 5 gigabyte now—that's like a thumb drive.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. You wouldn't even buy something like 5 gigabyte. Yeah, but anyway, no. So we tied that wine list into the inventory system.
Right.
And so every night we'd print out the wine list, and it would have the wines on it that were available because we know if we had sold the last one, it would not print out.
Yeah.
So we had it on a dot matrix. In those days, there was one font and one size. Mm-hmm. That was it. And I still have a copy of that list. It's a riot.
What? Okay. You know, most people of your generation, chefs, restaurateurs, Americans, are what we would today call career changers.
Yeah.
You're one of the few who early on said, I'm hitching my wagon to the food thing.
Right.
Right?
Right.
What gave you the confidence to do that? Did you have like future vision? Do you feel like you saw what was coming?
I had a very interesting segue into that final decision. My parents entertained all the time. They had great friends. And I saw the feeling and the vibe in their parties, whether it was a sit-down dinner party or it was a huge cocktail party or it was a outdoor barbecue or it was a beach thing or it was in the mountains or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I really learned about that. When I went away to France when I was 16 to the junior and high school program in France, my parents took me to a restaurant called Laurent right here.
Here in New York. Yes. This was before you shipped out.
Yes. And that night, because we grew up in the country, we didn't really know about restaurants like that.
Just so people know, you grew up in Briarcliff Manor.
Briarcliff Manor.
You spent summers up in Watch Hill
in Rhode Island. Yeah, okay. Musquamacut, and right there. And during the summer, I learned so much. My mother, you know, she was very tight to buy the lobsters, and we had the clams and the oysters were right in our backyard.
Yeah.
And the wife of the fisher dude, she grew all of the vegetables, I'm eating arugula in the 50s, in the 60s, when I'm a kid, tiny, don't even know what it is, it's green. So again, I really was that, but the night that we went there.
To Laurent. In Midtown Manhattan.
September, you just looked around, September 1969, people had just come back into the city, summer was over. They were all tanned. They were all dressed to the nines. You know, that room was beautiful. It looked like Maxime's, if you can just envision that. Mm-hmm. And it was a fantastic vibe in that room. And the people are eating and they're this. And then the owner walks in. And it's like they ratcheted up the energy. And I saw this. And I saw him walk around talking to people. And then my father and his friend argued over the bill. And it was just like, boom. It was like an epiphany. It was like, throw a party like my parents. Give everybody a bill at the end of the night. That's what the restaurant business is. That's what this show is. The next day, we get on the student boat, 1,500 kids on it. You know, us little 50 of 16-year-olds, and the rest were juniors in college going to abroad. Mm-hmm. It was called the SS Aurelia, and run by the Italians. So I, without even knowing, I go from France in America to Italy, where they have 5 meals a day. Mm-hmm. Everything is this sort of Dolce Vita kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing thing to see these waiters do their gig and the kind of food and the attention to this and that. It wasn't crap food. It was really great. It was a student boat.
Mm-hmm.
And that and because it was so old-fashioned, I think it took 11 days to get across the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And we dropped off in Le Havre. And then I moved into a family that they put you with for the year. And they were this magnificent folklore family, Breton. You know, it's Celtic. There's some Irish roots from thousands of years ago there. And it's a folklore thing where they have their own style of cooking. They have their own products. They have this and that. Brittany was a very sort of, still, not quite, you know, it's a poor region, a province. Mm-hmm. But it's really, really fierce. And they were the same way. They had parties all the time. They entertained this and that. So I'm getting this French thing. It's from them that I learned about the cooking school in Paris. And so when I saw those things, I said to myself, I remember graduating from the program in France and saying, okay, I have enough credits to go to college, and or I can go to Paris. And because they'd explained to me what the École Hôtelière was. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know about the Cordon Bleu in those days. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, this is what I want to do. I came back to the States. I got my high school diploma, and I started to think about it, and ended up going back to France and enrolled in those schools. And again, Steven Spurrier, you know, mm-hmm. they were just beginning to take wine from, we have Burgundy and we have Bordeaux, and then maybe Champagne. Those were the three areas that mm-hmm. existed. And they were expanding this thing into the Rhone, and they had the Loire and the Jura. And this is all France, because the wine in Italy was not very good in those days. Mm-hmm. And the wine, it was non-existent in Spain and Portugal. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? It was,
yeah.
They were primitive in terms of trying to get the stuff going in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. Everything exploded in the middle of the 80s mm-hmm. in those countries,
yeah,
as well as America.
But what... I don't know. It sounds like maybe you're just a really confident person. Mm. It just it still seems to me like such a leap.
Yeah.
At that time.
Well, my brother went
age.
On to be a lawyer. My other brother became a banker.
Exactly.
And my other brother became a political scientist. So, yeah. You know, and my father, you know, this is just what it was. But and it was pretty weird. I did say when I did come back, I was sort of an oddity. But Julia Child was on the cover of Newsweek, I think. And so it was this whole phenomena about French cooking.
It's so funny you point to that, because Bocuse yeah. was on the cover yeah. in 75.
Right.
And that comes up all the time. Mm-hmm. Because people don't realize that article was not just an article about Bocuse. It
right.
was an article about everything that was happening.
Right.
It was an article about people in the U.S. Matriculating at cooking schools.
Right.
It was an article about specialty
right.
Food shops and
right.
specialty cooking equipment shops.
Right.
And
it was great.
It was about the zeitgeist.
It was beginning.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah. and it was again, and everybody got on the bandwagon, which is why, you know, like when we did the dinner in 1983, why
this
that was
the Stanford
so fantastic.
Court
dinner. Yeah, which yeah. is why that was so fantastic, because Larry Forgione, he represented what we represented in California, he represented in New York City, in spades. I mean, it was over the top what he was doing, you mm-hmm. know, and his attention to the detail was like perfect.
Yeah.
You know, Alice Waters, Jeremiah Tower, and Mark Miller in San Francisco, the same thing. Mark was beginning to experiment with jalapenos and cilantro and lime
yeah.
and mesquite grilled quail.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, whoa.
Right.
Paul Prudhomme was just beginning his transformation of Cajun Creole food to a modern riff of that.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Schmidt in at the London Chop House. I found him through James Beard, because James was very tight with Lester Gruber, who owned it at mm-hmm. the time. And I said to James, I said, I got to get somebody from the Midwest.
Yeah.
And Larry, and then Paul, and then Bradley from the
Brad
Hallmark.
Brad Ogden.
Bradley was, you know, and I put them together saying, you guys represent the Midwest, you know, and... And they were perfect. They said, yeah, we got this great lamb in the Midwest. We got fantastic morels.
Right.
You know, the morels were fantastic.
Yeah. And just to give a sense of how much things have changed. So first of all, what you're referring to is a dinner I've been obsessed with for years.
Yes.
it was the first collaborative chef's dinner.
Regional American
yeah,
food.
There were like about 10 people.
Yep.
You just named them all. All the wines were American, which
yep.
was no small statement at
right.
the time. And... a lot of these people had never met.
These
people who are now like the Mount Rushmore chefs of the
right,
that era.
Right.
But Jimmy Schmidt and Brad Ogden,
yeah.
who were both in the Midwest,
yeah.
had never even spoken on the phone
right.
before you guys paired them up.
Yep.
They got on the phone to talk
yeah.
about this course they were
yeah.
going to do together.
Yeah.
They had heard of each other,
yeah.
but they had never even had a phone call.
Well, there was no internet.
No social media.
No
yeah.
social media.
Yeah.
There was no James Beard Awards.
There were,
you know,
no,
there were no
fundraising dinners
no.
every night of the week.
The closest thing to anything in the 80s was the National Restaurant Association had their big weekend in their fair, their show
yes.
in Chicago. And I remember distinctly going there and
yeah.
being inaugurated into all these Hall of Fame awards
right,
of
right,
this
right.
and that and this.
Sure.
And it was like me. And then there were like, 40 guys in their 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because,
yeah.
and the restaurants that they ran, you know, like the Sardine Factory.
Yeah.
And all of these fantastic restaurants that
yeah.
were icons in their own sense.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the generation.
Yeah. Last question for you. I am so struck when I talk to people who of your generation in this business. You know, my God, Michael Santa Monica, 40 years. Okay. And can I say this? I don't
yeah.
want to be... You had a little stretch there where it was a little tenuous. It's, at least it seemed that way.
Oh, it was very difficult in 92 to 95.
Yeah.
That was a very yeah. difficult time.
So, you know, there's really nothing left to prove.
Right.
The restaurant is now as popular as it's been in forever.
Yeah.
But I'm really struck because you guys all started so young.
Right.
you know, to sit with someone like you and talk about 1975, to sit with Nancy Silverton and talk about her first jobs, you know, in Northern California around the same time.
Right.
First of all, nobody seems or looks old enough to have actually been around. You guys all seem and look younger than one would imagine of someone who started a career that long ago.
Yeah.
But you guys are also, it's so amazing. You know, Jonathan Waxman, you know, you, Nancy, Cindy Paulson.
Like,
a lot of you are still working.
I know, it's
really
weird.
You're in your restaurants. You seem to be as passionate as ever.
Yeah.
There's people half your age who, you know, were in the trenches for a few years. And there's nothing wrong with this, but have moved on to television. And, But you guys seem, it doesn't seem addictive or dysfunctional. It just seems like a real lifelong passion that you don't want to let go of.
Yeah, well, that
is. Is it that simple?
It is. It is. You know, as you
like see. You still love coming to your restaurants
every
day.
Oh, I do. That's what I love the most.
Yeah.
You know, it's always been about that. I mean, I love the people, the crowd we get here, the crowd we get there. They're just wonderful people. It's constantly evolving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like as I said, you know, in New York, we started out with young Hollywood. Now we have a whole nother Hollywood, and we've got a whole nother tech industry in Santa Monica. And we've got all of these people, and they all love art. They love food. They love wine, and they're into the program.
Yeah.
And it's really, again, we're almost gone full circle to just creating that experience that people want. And, you know, you find a lot of the newer restaurants coming up, they've forgotten the word hospitality. And I don't even like to bring it up because it sounds so old-fashioned. But it's true. Human beings still want to have the recognition, the whole thing. And
what do you mean the recognition?
Well, in other words, they want to know that they have a club. And so what we create are clubs that anybody can attend. As I say, well,
but
how
the
do we get
it's a club vibe.
It's a club vibe. It's and how do you become a member of that club? You eat there a lot. You become a regular. You're not an idiot. You know, we weed out bad people automatically. It's like a self-weeding out program. And that's what we have here. I mean, you know, and it's, so it's great. It's like you're having a dinner party every night in your house. Crazy.
Well, congratulations on 40 years. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
It's really amazing. And I'm sure you're in high demand the next 4 weeks, so thanks for making time to sit down with me.
All right, very good.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, buddy.
And that's our show for this week. Again, a huge thank you to Michael McCarty. He's given me a lot of time in the past, and I would love spending an hour with him again and having an hour of audio that I was able to share with all of you. Again, a reminder, their 40th anniversary party at Michael's Santa Monica is Sunday, April 28th from noon to 4 p.m. with an all-star roster of chefs and vintners sharing what they do. I think it's going to be a great time. I'm actually thinking about buying a ticket and flying out. I don't know if I'll be able to do it, but I'd like to. Jeet Paul, our engineer, thank you very much for everything you do every week and splicing these things together. To everyone at Heritage, thanks for all your support, as always. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we will be back next week with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.